In our previous lecture, we looked at the Supreme Court's rulings in four cases that challenged racial segregation in higher education and that were decided between 1938 and 1950. These were cases brought by lawyers for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the nation's leading civil rights group. During these years, the NAACP's legal office was headed by a remarkable lawyer, Thurgood Marshall, who later became the first African-American to sit on the Supreme Court. We saw how Marshall began his long-range campaign against school segregation with a strategy of encirclement and attrition. He felt that challenging the exclusion of black students from graduate studies and law schools in border states would produce favorable judicial rulings and would build precedent for a final assault on Jim Crow schooling in the Deep South. As we saw, Marshall brought suits that forced the admission of black students to graduate programs and law schools in Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. But the Supreme Court declined Marshall's invitation in these cases to overturn the separate but equal doctrine of the Plessy case in 1896. In this lecture, we'll continue the story of Marshall's effort to put the Plessy ruling squarely before the Supreme Court. We're going to look at five cases that reached the court in 1952 and that were finally decided in 1954 in the historic ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. We'll discuss the arguments in these cases and the behind-the-scenes debates that led to the Brown decision in our next lecture. But I think it's important to set the stage for those arguments and deliberations. Let me explain the purpose of this lecture. In my classroom teaching, I try to dispel what I call the stork theory of Supreme Court cases. Just like babies don't arrive on the doorsteps of our homes in a basket carried by a stork, cases don't arrive at the court's chambers in a basket complete with briefs and lawyers. Every case the court decides has a history and a record. These histories and records and the rulings of lower court judges shape the issues before the Supreme Court and affect its decisions. So we're going to look first at the five Brown cases before they reach the court for decision. These are human stories, and we'll look at the people who brought these cases, the lawyers who argued them, and the lower court judges who made the rulings the court reviewed. We're going to begin and devote the most time to the case Thurgood Marshall picked as the first challenge to school segregation in the Deep South. This case began in 1947 in the small town of Summerton, South Carolina. Summerton is located in Clarendon County, one of the most heavily black and poorest counties in South Carolina. In 1947, Clarendon County had some 32,000 residents, more than 70% of them black. Almost all the black families lived on farms, but few owned their land. They raised cotton and worked as sharecroppers for white owners. More than two-thirds of the black families earned less than $1,000 a year, and more than a third of all black adults could not read or write. In fact, hardly any had gone beyond the sixth grade, in schools that held classes just 6 months a year, so that children could weed and pick cotton. The county spent $179 for each white child in public school, but only $43 to educate each black child. The schools for blacks had no desks, no electricity, and no indoor plumbing. This was the reality of Jim Crow education in 1947, not only in Clarendon County, but in most states in the Deep South. On the surface, blacks and whites got along well in Summerton. The town's white mayor, H.C. Kerrigan, owned the Sinclair gas station and several farms with black tenants. "Colored have made wonderful progress down here," he told a visiting reporter. "I sharecrop with them, and they are all as happy as can be." But not all the county's blacks were happy. Joseph Richburg, a black teacher, said, "There was a lot going on that we didn't like, but everything was fine so long as we kept saying yes, sir, and no, sir, and tipping our hat." But one black man in Clarendon County did not tip his hat to whites. The Reverend Joseph Delane was pastor of the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Summerton, and he also taught in a rural black school. His students walked to school along dirt roads, some for miles. Their clothes were often spattered with dust or mud from the school buses that carried white children to their school in a large brick building in Somerton. But the county school board did not provide any buses for the black children. Reverend Delane approached a black farmer named Levi Pearson, who owned his land and was known for standing up to whites. Pearson had to drive his three children 9 miles to the Scotts Branch School. He agreed to sign a petition that had been drafted for Delane by Harold Boulware, the state's only black civil rights lawyer, asking the county school board to provide buses for black children. Delane then visited the county's white school superintendent, the Reverend L.B. McCord, who was also a pastor in the Presbyterian Church. "I was one of McCord's good niggers," Reverend Delane said, but not after this meeting in July of 1947. McCord curtly rejected the petition from Levi Pearson. He told Delane the county did not have any funds to purchase more buses. So in March of 1948, Harold Boulware filed a suit in federal court, seeking an injunction to bar county officials from making any distinction on account of race or color in busing children to school. But the case was dismissed after county officials discovered that Pearson's farm straddled the line between two school districts. He paid property taxes in one district, and his children attended school in another. Levi Pearson paid for his stand. Every white-owned bank and store cut off his credit. No white farmer would rent him a harvester, and his crops rotted in the field. But Pearson did not give up. In March of 1949, Harold Boulware summoned him and Reverend Delane to his office in Columbia, the state's capital. Thurgood Marshall had come from New York to South Carolina, looking for plaintiffs who were willing to ask for more than buses. Marshall told the black farmer and the black preacher that he wanted to file a suit that would demand equal schools for black children. And he wanted to file that suit against Clarendon County to expose the myth of separate but equal in South Carolina's most unequal county. Marshall asked the two men to find at least 20 plaintiffs to join the suit and spread the risk of retaliation. It took Pearson and Delane 8 months to find 20 black parents who were willing to challenge the county's white power structure. The first in alphabetical order was Harry Briggs, a Navy veteran with 5 children. Briggs pumped gas and fixed cars at Mayor Kerrigan's station in Somerton, and his wife Eliza worked as a motel chambermaid. Harold Boulware drafted a complaint that asked for equal funding of the county's schools, buildings, teachers, books, and buses. He filed the complaint in federal court in Charleston in November of 1949, listing Thurgood Marshall as co-counsel. The first defendant in the suit was Roderick Elliott, the county's school board chairman. Word spread quickly in Clarendon County that Negras had sued the school board, and whites quickly retaliated. Virtually every plaintiff paid a heavy price for joining the suit. Mayor Kerrigan fired Harry Briggs on Christmas Eve, handing him a carton of cigarettes as severance pay. Eliza Briggs lost her motel job. John McDonald, a combat veteran of Iwo Jima, lost his farm credit. Bo Stooks lost his garage job, and James Brown was fired by a trucking company. Reverend Delane's house was burned to the ground, and he left the state to protect his family. Thurgood Marshall was delighted when the case of Briggs versus Elliott was assigned to a federal judge named J. Waddies Waring. Judge Waring was a South Carolina native who was born in 1880. His father had owned slaves and his uncles had fought for the Confederacy. But Waring had turned against his state's Jim Crow system. He ruled in 1945 that South Carolina must equalize the salaries of black and white teachers. And in 1948, Marshall had argued before Waring that state officials could not exclude blacks from voting in primary elections. "It is time for South Carolina to rejoin the Union," Waring had written in this case. But he gave Marshall a surprise at the first hearing in the Briggs case. The judge urged Marshall to amend his complaint and to attack South Carolina's segregation laws directly as violating the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Marshall complied, but he lost his advantage in the courtroom. Under federal judicial rules, constitutional challenges to state laws came before three-judge panels, headed by a federal appellate judge. So Waring was joined on the bench for the Briggs trial by two other judges. John Parker of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia had been nominated to the Supreme Court in 1930 by President Hoover. But the Senate rejected him, largely because he had spoken against black voting as a Republican candidate for governor in his native state of North Carolina. But Parker later gained the respect of NAACP lawyers as a fair judge. He was noted, however, for sticking to precedent. The third judge on the Briggs panel was George Timmerman of South Carolina, who was known as a diehard defender of segregation. So when the Briggs trial began in May of 1951, everyone in the packed courtroom knew the outcome rested on Parker's vote. The trial opened with another surprise. The school board's lawyer, Robert Figg, conceded that Clarendon County schools were unequal in their facilities. Figg assured the judges that state lawmakers would soon provide funds to equalize black and white schools in rural counties. This concession, Figg said, would eliminate the necessity of taking a great deal of testimony in the case. His purpose was clear to Thurgood Marshall. Figg wanted to keep Marshall's chief witness off the stand and prevent him from making a record for the Supreme Court to review. But Judge Parker allowed Marshall to proceed, and he called Kenneth Clark to the stand. Clark was an eminent black social psychologist with a doctorate from Columbia University. He was also the nation's leading authority on the impact of racial segregation on black children. As we'll see in our next lecture, Clark's testimony at the Briggs trial had a great impact on the Supreme Court's later ruling in the Brown case. His testimony was essential to the case against Jim Crow schooling. Marshall's amended complaint argued that the inequality of Clarendon County schools was not the real issue before the judges. The real issue was the system of segregation. Marshall argued that racial separation was per se unconstitutional. This Latin term means by itself. In other words, even if the black and white schools were equal in quality, segregation by itself violated the Constitution. Marshall called Kenneth Clark as a witness to show that enforced segregation made black children feel inferior to whites. And these feelings of inferiority stemmed from the Jim Crow system, which taught black children they were unfit to attend school with white children. Clark made this case with a simple but revealing test. He had visited the Scotts Branch School in Clarendon County and sat down with 16 black children, one at a time. He showed each child a pair of dolls that were identical in every respect but color. One doll was white and the other was brown. Clark asked each child, "Give me the white doll. Now give me the colored doll." The kids all picked the right doll. Then Clark asked, "Give me the doll that is a nice color. Give me the doll that looks bad." 9 of the black kids said the white doll had the nice color, and 11 said the brown doll looked bad to them. Clark explained his doll test to the judges and then stated his conclusion. "These children in Clarendon County, like other human beings who are subjected to an obviously inferior status in the society in which they live, have been definitely harmed in the development of their personalities. The effect of segregation," Clark added, "was to create basic feelings of inferiority in black children." Thurgood Marshall did not expect Clark's testimony to sway Judges Parker and Timmerman. He was building a record for the Supreme Court. And when Parker issued the panel's ruling in June of 1951, his opinion did not even mention Clark's name. Parker stood firmly behind the Plessy decision, calling it overwhelming authority, which we are not at liberty to disregard on the basis of theories advanced by a few educators and sociologists. School segregation, Parker concluded, was grounded in reason and experience. He gave the school board 6 months to report on its progress toward equalizing the county's black and white schools. Judge Timmerman joined Parker's opinion, leaving Judge Waring in dissent. His lengthy opinion covered the history of slavery and segregation and denounced what he called the sadistic insistence of the white supremacists in declaring that their will must be imposed, irrespective of the rights of other citizens. Waring pointed to Kenneth Clark's assertion that the mere fact of segregation itself had a deleterious and warping effect upon the minds of children. Clark's testimony convinced Waring that segregation in education can never produce equality and is an evil that must be eradicated. He put his final words in italics to make sure they stood out. Segregation is per se inequality. But Waring had been outvoted, and Plessy remained standing as precedent. Marshall promptly filed an appeal with the Supreme Court, making Briggs versus Elliott the first case to challenge segregation in primary and secondary schools. The next case to reach the court began in the small town of Farmville, a town of some 5,000 residents in the tobacco-growing region of southern Virginia. Prince Edward County, of which Farmville was the business and government center, was almost evenly divided between blacks and whites. More than two-thirds of the county's black adults had not gone past the sixth grade, and their children attended overcrowded and run-down Jim Crow schools. The campaign against segregated education began with a protest march on the morning of April 23rd in 1951. The march was led by a 16-year-old girl named Barbara Rose Johns, who was a junior at the all-black Robert A. Moton High School. She had organized her fellow students to demand that the county build a new school and replace the tar paper shacks in which overflow classes were held. The shacks had no insulation or electricity, and students wore their overcoats to stay warm in the winter months. After the school board ignored their repeated demands, Barbara recruited a small team to plan a strike. She had someone call the school's principal and tell him that students were in trouble at the downtown bus station. After he rushed out, Barbara sent her team members to each classroom, telling the teachers of an emergency assembly in the auditorium. When the students gathered, Barbara took the podium and told the astonished teachers to leave. One teacher who objected was grabbed by the arms and hustled out. Barbara then informed the students that she was leading a march to the school board office in downtown Farmville. The marchers shouldered picket signs that had been stored in the carpentry shop and paraded to the town center with signs that read, "We are tired of tar paper shacks. We want a new school." The Moton students remained on strike until two lawyers from the NAACP office in Richmond arrived in Farmville. Spotswood Robinson and Oliver Hill had received a letter from Barbara Johns asking for legal help. They met with the students and told them the NAACP, as Robinson put it, would be interested in nothing short of a desegregation suit. Barbara's parents were concerned about her safety and sent her to live with relatives in Alabama. So Dorothy Davis, a 15-year-old Moton student, became the lead plaintiff in Davis versus Prince Edward County. The NAACP lawyers again called Kenneth Clark, who testified about his interviews with Moton High students. They all told him, Clark said, the conditions in their school made them feel that whites wanted to keep blacks down. The three federal judges who decided the case in March of 1952 were all natives of Virginia, loyal to its customs and traditions. There was never any doubt about the outcome of the trial, Oliver Hill said. We were trying to build a record for the Supreme Court. The judicial panel once again ignored Clark's testimony. Judge Albert Bryan wrote that school segregation in Virginia, as he put it, has for generations been a part of the mores of her people. In practice, it has begotten greater opportunities for the Negro. We have found no hurt or harm to either race. This ends our inquiry. But Bryan's ruling did not end the Davis case. Thurgood Marshall authorized his Virginia colleagues to file an appeal with the Supreme Court, which granted the petition for review. A third case began in the nation's capital, just a mile south of the court's marble building. On September 11th of 1950, 11 black children filed into the principal's office at John Philip Sousa Junior High in southeast Washington, D.C. They were escorted by an outspoken and determined black man named Gardner Bishop. He operated a barber shop in the city's black section about 2 miles north of the White House. Bishop had organized a parents' group in 1947 to protest the overcrowding of Washington's black schools after his daughter, Judine, was turned away from the all-white school nearest to her home. Segregation in the capital schools had been imposed in the 1860s by Congress, which governed the District of Columbia. Congress had also required that equal amounts be spent for the education of children, regardless of race. But the district school board had ignored this mandate. In 1950, blacks made up more than a third of the city's 800,000 residents, but their kids were squeezed into overcrowded schools, while hundreds of seats remained empty at the all-white schools. Gardner Bishop attended every meeting of the district school board and finally got tired of the excuses its members gave for not building new schools for black children. That's why he took the 11 black kids to Sousa Junior High, a brand new school with several empty classrooms. He knew they would be turned away, but he wanted to make a point. One of the students who left the Sousa school that day was Spotswood Bowling Jr., a 12-year-old whose widowed mother worked for the federal government as a bookbinder. Spotswood spent his seventh grade year at Shaw Junior High, an overcrowded school in a rundown neighborhood. He became the lead plaintiff in a suit that had been prepared by James Neighbert, a Howard Law School professor who had volunteered to help Gardner Bishop's crusade for better schools. The first defendant in the case was Melvin Sharp, the president of the district school board. James Neighbert agreed to file the suit in Bowling versus Sharp with one condition. He wanted to launch a direct attack on the separate but equal doctrine of the Plessy case. The complaint that Neighbert drafted made no mention of unequal school facilities in Washington. It also did not mention the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which affected only the states. The District of Columbia was not and still isn't a state. So Neighbert based his complaint on the Due Process Clause of the 5th Amendment, arguing that racial segregation deprived black children of their liberty to use the same public schools as whites. But the Bowling case never reached a trial. Ruling in April of 1951, District Judge Walter Bastian dismissed the suit without an opinion. Neighbert appealed this ruling to the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington, but the Supreme Court added the Bowling case to its docket in October of 1952 without waiting for an appellate decision. Another challenge to segregation began in the state of Delaware when two angry black mothers complained to school officials about their children's treatment. Sarah Bulaw's 6-year-old daughter, Shirley, attended a one-room elementary school for black children in the rural town of Hockessin. This is an area just south of the Mason-Dixon line that separates Delaware from Pennsylvania. The Hockessin School Board provided a bus for white children that went right past Shirley's home but would not pick her up. Sarah Bulaw wrote to the state's education director, but he ignored her letter. She then wrote to Delaware's governor, who replied that state law required segregation in all school facilities. Consequently, he said, Shirley may not ride on a bus serving a white school. Another black mother, Ethel Belton, lived in the town of Claymont, 15 miles north of Delaware's biggest city, Wilmington. Her teenage daughter, Ethel Louise, could not attend the all-white Claymont High School and had to ride a bus for 2 hours each day to attend all-black Howard High School in downtown Wilmington. Howard was surrounded by factories and rundown tenements, and students had to walk 9 blocks to another building for vocational classes. Although the two mothers didn't know each other, they both contacted Lewis Redding, the state's only black lawyer who handled civil rights cases. Sarah Bulaw recalled her first meeting with Reddy. He said he wouldn't help me get a Jim Crow bus to take my girl to any Jim Crow school. But if I was interested in sending her to an integrated school, why then maybe he'd help. Well, I thank God right then and there. Redding filed two suits against the state's Board of Education, with Frances Gebhardt as the first defendant. The cases were consolidated for a hearing before a young state judge named Collins Seitz. He had already ruled in 1950 that the University of Delaware must admit black students, citing the Supreme Court decisions in the Sweat and McLaurin cases for precedent. 2 years later, he became the first judge to order state officials to admit black children to white public schools. The only way to give Shirley Bulaw and Ethel Belton an equal education, Seitz wrote, was by admission to the school with superior facilities. He added these words to his opinion. I believe the separate but equal doctrine in education should be rejected, but I also believe its rejection should come from the Supreme Court. The state's appeal from this ruling joined the court's growing docket of segregation cases. Now, the one plaintiff in school cases that everyone knows by name is Linda Carol Brown. She lived in Topeka, the state capital of Kansas, and was beginning the third grade in the fall of 1950. The Sumner Elementary School was just six blocks away from her home. Her father, Oliver Brown, repaired freight cars for the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. He took Linda to the Sumner School, but was told that she had been assigned to the all-black Monroe School, more than a mile away. Linda had to cross several railroad tracks and walk six blocks to catch a bus to the Monroe School. Oliver Brown was also a part-time pastor at the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Topeka, and had given benedictions at the meetings of the city's NAACP chapter. The president of the chapter was an outspoken man named McKinley Burnett, who had attended school board meetings for years, demanding that Topeka end segregation in its grade schools. Back in 1879, the Kansas legislature had authorized cities with more than 15,000 residents to establish segregated elementary schools. Wichita and Topeka were the only cities of this size, and only Topeka had taken advantage of this law, setting aside four grade schools for black children. McKinley Burnett wrote to Thurgood Marshall in 1950, asking for help in challenging school segregation in Topeka. Marshall enlisted the city's leading black lawyer, Elisha Scott, to file a suit in federal court on behalf of Oliver Brown and 13 other black parents. Scott picked Brown as the lead plaintiff because he was the only male among this group. When the Brown case came to trial in June of 1951, before a three-judge panel, the NAACP lawyers called a young sociology professor from the University of Kansas as their chief witness. Louisa Holt testified that racial segregation, as she put it, is inevitably interpreted both by white people and by Negroes as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group. Chief Judge Walter Huxman was impressed by Holt's testimony, but he relied on the Plessy case in ruling against the plaintiffs in the Brown case. Huxman later said, "We weren't in sympathy with the decision we rendered, but there was no way around the Plessy case. The Supreme Court would have to overrule itself." Now, we've looked in this lecture at the human stories of the five school cases that reached the court for argument in December of 1952. We've seen the courage of people like the Reverend Joseph Delane, Barbara Johns, Gardner Bishop, Sarah Bulaw, Ethel Belton, and McKinley Burnett. They all faced hostility and retaliation for challenging the Jim Crow system in public schools. In our next lecture, we'll look at the justices of the Supreme Court to see whether they had the courage to overrule the Plessy case and to decide whether school segregation violated the Constitution. As we'll see, this was a crucial and dramatic chapter in the court's history.